interested in the worm bins, but it seems a little bit intimidating to have worms hanging out in the kitchen.
In my backyard, the planting areas are postage stamp.
I'm Lisa Rothman, and you're listening to Chew On This, Fresh Ideas Made to Order. Today, how to garden even if you have a yard the size of a futon. I'm surrounded by 10 food trucks at the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco. That looks amazing. What is that?
It's a creamy, spicy scallop street maki. A tempura roll, essentially, with a creamy, spicy scallop pretty much drizzled all over it.
It's very saucy.
I like the spicy texture and the perfectly done rice.
I'm getting one of those. I'm Lisa Rothman. Welcome to Chew On This. We take a challenge people face in their daily lives and ask experts how to handle it. We're at the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco. 10 food trucks serving up lunch and dinner 7 days a week. Today, how to garden, even if you don't have a big yard. Mae Nguyen is with an organization called Planting Justice, which works with people who've been in prison, employing them to plant edible gardens in low-income neighborhoods. Jay Rosenberg is the co-founder of 49 Farms. They're putting at least one farm in each and every one of San Francisco's 49 square miles. Let's have a round of applause for our experts. Right now, we're under a highway overpass across the street from a Costco. Why on earth are we talking about gardening here? Because there are actually two farms within three blocks of here. One of the reasons urban farming is doing so well in San Francisco and across the nation is because cities like Detroit, Baltimore, New York, Seattle, Oakland, and San Francisco have passed laws to encourage gardening. Gardening on vacant lots and land that the city owns. Chew On This correspondent Charlie Mintz visited a few of these farms.
Carrie Hughes stands on the sidewalk near a chain-link fence on the corner of Fell and Laguna Streets in San Francisco. Behind us, cars roar past the rows of tidy Victorians. But Hughes is more interested in the wide, sloping lot in front of us, on the other side of the fence.
This is how you get on the Bay Bridge. This is how you get onto, 101, etc. But that was, back in 1989.
She points at a strip of cracked pavement cutting through the lot. It's the last remnants of a freeway on-ramp that collapsed in the Loma Prieta earthquake. From then until 2010, this space was abandoned.
It's 21 years that this area was not used, as far as I know, for anything outside of just drug use and trash. So
that's all gone. Now the lot's occupied by the Hayes Valley Farm. It's 2 acres, sunny in parts, shady in others, with tall trees clustered in the center. The pungent smell of compost wafts over beds of chard, kale, bamboo, all sprouted, quite literally, from the freeway's remains. The farm produces thousands of pounds of food a year. Making that happen took a big idea.
Permaculture.
Permaculture. It's a design method focused on using space efficiently, working with nature, and sustaining resources rather than depleting them. It aims to get the most use out of the least amount of space, which makes it perfect for urban gardening. As an example, Hughes points out a spiral mound of dirt at the south end of the farm.
The mound is about 3 feet tall, I guess, and about 4 feet wide. It does look like a little volcano.
It's actually a super efficient herb garden.
Basically, it's building up, and so you basically are going to get definitely 2x or 3x or even 4x the amount of food off of this same square footage of space.
Permaculture is everywhere at the farm. It's in the farm's shape, which uses natural slopes to draw water downward. It's in the seed library, which houses and shares special seeds that thrive in San Francisco's climate. It's even in the ground you walk on. Back in 2010, volunteers covered the site with more than 80,000 pounds of cardboard and organic matter to create a rich, human-made soil. These are all big ideas that fit well in this small space. But maybe the biggest idea was one that, on its face, actually seems like the opposite of permaculture.
Since September 2009, when we started designing the project, we designed it to be temporary.
Jay Rosenberg helped start Hayes Valley Farm, It's on property owned by the city of San Francisco. And he says the project was always meant to be a placeholder, something to do with the space until the economy picked up and a developer built it out.
Sort of like the city has a driveway and they're letting us put a lemonade stand on it.
In technical terms, this is an interim use agreement. That's what allowed the farm to operate for the past 3 years. The interim's up, though. Construction on a condo/retail development is set to start sometime in 2013. And what Rosenberg calls the freeway food forest is supposed to clear out entirely by the summer. But Rosenberg says that's okay. Permaculture is a way of designing for the long term, of planning for sustainability under any circumstances. Knowing the farm site would be temporary, let the farmers make plans to endure. To see how, we'll have to follow the bees.
Sign says, caution, no trespassing, honeybee yard. Do not disturb the honeybees. Their pollination work ensures our food supply.
Long before they knew exactly when they'd have to leave, Hayes Valley farmers started moving bees from the farm to this site on San Bruno Avenue, right above the 101 freeway. It's about 4 miles away. Hundreds of thousands of bees, almost a dozen colonies, made the trip. Their new caretaker, in her white protective suit, is Karen Peteros, co-founder of San Francisco Bee Cause.
These kind of projects really do build community. Sometimes it doesn't seem that obvious, but if you start up a project in the neighborhood, it's kind of like they will come, you know?
And they have been. Peteros says curious neighbors have started poking around regularly. Some even want to volunteer. For the most part, beekeeping in a city, it's a lot like beekeeping anywhere. But getting the land to keep your bees, that's a distinctly urban story. And one with unusual bedfellows.
It says 1X plus.
Looming over us is a huge Clear Channel billboard advertising a new phone. The lot we're standing on, Clear Channel owns that too. Buildings would block the billboard, so the company always kept this lot vacant. Until Peteros went to them with an idea.
It was just a fallow lot. It was just an ugly weed lot. So we told them we'd take it from an eyesore to eye candy, become a neighborhood asset rather than a neighborhood negative.
Peteros isn't just a beekeeper. She's also an award-winning employment attorney, in case you're wondering how she negotiated with a multi-billion dollar corporation. Long story short, she secured a one-year lease, basically for free. In spring of 2013, that lease goes month to month, though, which means Clear Channel can terminate it at any point. Peteros says this is just a reality that urban agriculture projects have to deal with.
You know, whenever you have any property in the city, especially if privately owned, you never can guarantee that you'll have it for any period of time, so we'll just have to take it one season at a time.
If the apiary loses its lease, the bees will have to move to another site. The way the farmers see it, though, that's okay. Permaculture means working with the environment that exists around you. If that means making a garden temporary but mobile, so be it. If that means asking favors from a corporation, fine. The goal, says Jay Rosenberg, is to get as much of San Francisco planted as possible.
I'm checking the map first. We're entering mile 34, and we're leaving mile 27, which is just east of mile 26, where we started.
Rosenberg's driving the city in a van. He's navigating with a map subdivided into 49 square miles. His goal is to see at least one community garden in each. Right now, the map includes everything from a planned bioremediation in Hunter's Point to a school garden where pumpkins grow through a chain-link fence. But there are also neighborhoods that still don't have any community gardens.
And out here, there's spaces that are just pretty much blank.
To fix this, Rosenberg is working with a project called 49 Farms. It's an attempt to link up existing farms, help new ones begin, and achieve that goal of a community garden in every one of the city's 49 square miles. The plan is to make San Francisco agriculture thrive, whether by providing especially resilient seeds or helping aspiring farmers navigate complex city bureaucracy.
There's so many places to make a mistake and to check the wrong box on a form or put the wrong thing in your application that we've made a long list of these mistakes.
Urban gardening takes more than just a green thumb. It takes a creative approach to working in a city, with governments, with corporations, and with unused space, whether it's the lot down the corner or a corner of your backyard. Permaculture is the guiding principle, permanent change the ultimate goal. But in a city developing as fast as San Francisco, where empty lots don't stay empty long, permanent doesn't necessarily mean putting down roots in just one place. For Chew on This, I'm Charlie Mintz.
All the organizations that were just mentioned, and many more, are up on our website, chewonthisradio.com. We're at the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco. We've got urban gardening experts Jay Rosenberg with 49 Farms and Mae Nguyen with Planting Justice. We've also got people here who want to do some urban farming. Jay Rosenberg, what have you brought for us?
Well, we brought these, we call them the magic beans. Dangers of giants and losing your last cow are not really a risk here. But most importantly, we have some amazing magic beans that really are going to grow well in San Francisco. And for folks who want to get a little dirty while we're on the air here, we're going to get a chance to go ahead and do that.
Great, let's do it.
So there's a pretty amazing mix of magic beans here. It starts with Scarlet Runners, which are a tall, tall climbing, almost like a big pea pod. And the way Scarlet Runners grow is they'll grow tall, and they'll climb anything you can get. Mostly you don't even need any good fertilizer in your soil, so we have some pretty nutrient-deficient soil here, and we'll be using that to grow the beans. The beans will provide the nutrient in a magic sort of way. So in the mix, beyond just the Scarlet Runner, what we'll find is there's also some sweet peas and green beans that grow in a bush form. So if we plant them and the Scarlet Runner doesn't grow, it may be that it was too sunny for the Scarlet Runners, or it was too dry for Scarlet Runners. So we put a few other beans in the mix that are dry, drought tolerant, and maybe like a little bit more sun. So we'll find there's a pigeon pea in here, which is the typical dal of continental India.
I got more beans.
So do you already have a garden?
No, I have a ledge and a landing, but I'm interested in the whole process of small gardening.
So do you have an idea of where these are going to go? Are they going to go on the ledge?
I'm trying to figure that out right now, but I'll make some kind of a climbing place for it and figure it out.
I predict by the end of the show you might get some suggestions about how these could work on your ledge. How about you? Do you have a garden?
Well, we have a garden in Pacifica, but my business is in Hayward. It's an industrial business, so I'm thinking of growing these along. We have a yard in the back. It's an industrial yard, and we're going to grow it up along our fence and our barbed wire fence. And I'll just change my name to Jack.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to finish planting these magic beans and be right back. You're listening to Chew on This. I'm Lisa Rothman. If you're just joining us, we're finding out how to garden even if you have very little space. Our gardening experts are Jay Rosenberg, founder of 49 Farms, and Mae Nguyen. She's a permaculture designer with Planting Justice, a nonprofit organization that has an unusual fee structure. For every three gardens they plant at full price, they plant a garden at the home of a low-income family for free. Now it's time to get our questions answered. My dad's a gardener, and my kids love gardening, but apparently the gardening gene skipped a generation. I killed a cactus. Anyway, my dad brought this planter box over for our front yard, and he and the kids planted these melon seeds in it. And those melons started out gangbusters. We're talking vines spreading and leaves unfurling and flowers blooming. And this little melon appeared, and we were so excited. But then weeks went by, and that sad little gumball of a melon didn't get any bigger. Yeah, we watered. And then everything just withered and died. What went wrong?
Tell me more about the melon. What color was it?
It was green and kind of striped yellow. I mean, it was kind of small because it was the size of a gumball when it appeared. Mm-hmm. So are you saying that there are some melons that do better in planters than others?
I think some melons do better in this type of climate than others. Part of why a lot of watermelons grow so well in the South like in the southern United States is because they have really, really hot days, but then it gets pretty cold at night too. And a lot of melons actually really need that cold night to really ripen and get super juicy and sweet. So that's the first thing that kind of came up for me in wondering maybe why this little guy couldn't make it through.
What do you think, Jay?
Oh, I just had an idea. Can you like imagine the garden where it was growing, the little box? And maybe you see the garden itself. You see the melon, the little withering vine, all sad, and all that work you put into it. And do you see the soil around the melon? Can you describe that?
It was some organic potting soil out of a bag.
Mm. And tell me more. Like, what, did you just buy it from a bag and dump it right in the box, threw a melon in, and just hope for the best?
That's an accurate description of what happened.
Would you say that was the last time you added anything to that garden box as far as soil or maybe, like, something else?
Yes.
I could say that. I'm sure you watered plenty. I'm sure you sang to that melon. I'm sure you loved that melon.
I'm pretty sure it just
froze to death, basically. And the way that we like to think of melons as not freezing to death is just like if it was cold at night, we give it a little blanket. And a blanket for any garden, especially one with a weird San Francisco climate, where in the middle of, what, January winter afternoon, we're sitting here in sun, but in the middle of, you know, I think it's freezing at the summer nights. Like, it's very confusing for a melon. They need a blanket. And what we use, well, it's pretty much what you guys all have a little tub of right in front of you. It's basically some soil. You just add to the box every once in a while, kind of keep it alive. And you're like, well, where am I going to get some soil? The best thing you can do is just some mulch, you know, just some wood chip mulch, some straw mulch, something pretty. They use these fancy mulches you can even buy in the store with mosses, and I'm not going to advocate for that, but you can get some nice mulch. And if you add that to your soil, the garden will actually not freeze to death.
All right, I'm going to give that a try. Let's have a question from someone in our audience here at the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco.
John Toccolino, I'm in Mountain View, and I'm renting a house that has a very small garden, but my question is, we use permaculture, the word permaculture, but what does that mean for a tiny garden in a backyard of a 800, 1,200 square foot rental house?
Well, what it would mean for any space is just how to maximize the amount of food you can get out of whatever size that space is. It really just depends on, first, what you want. Do you want to be getting as many vegetables out of that space as possible? Do you want to be getting fruits? Do you want to have chickens? Do you want to have your fruit trees being watered by your laundry water?
I'd love chickens, of course, but I don't think that's practical right now.
Uh-huh.
Compost to start, then vegetables of some sort, and fruit would be great, but fruit might be a bit much also.
Cool. If you have enough space to do one or two 4x8 foot raised beds, that'll get you probably everything you need for you and your family. And there's actually a really amazing way of planting fruit trees where you can actually train them to grow along your fence and not take up any, instead of being big round bushes, they'll actually be flat. It's called espaliering trees. So we put those in as much as we can because you can just stick fruit trees around the perimeter of your yard. And then you can also have those trees watered through a gray water system, and you can reroute water from your washing machine into your landscape and actually be using your water twice in a way. And then if you had like a 4x10 space, you could actually have a couple chickens running around in your yard there. I know that's not something you want right now, but...
That's legal in California. There's not a... I just
moved
here.
Oh, yeah. You can have hens here in the city and in the East Bay.
And in many cities throughout the United States.
Most cities. Yeah, and as far as the composting systems go, yeah, the worm bins are really the way to go. They're really small, about a foot by 2 feet, and you can just kind of stick them in any warm place that you have, and they're really efficient and compact.
What do you mean by worm bin?
It's they're either wooden or plastic bins. With stackable trays. So they also make use of vertical space, which is a big permaculture concept as well.
All right. Thank you much.
Hi, my name is Sandeep Brar. I'm interested in the worm bins, but it seems a little bit intimidating to have worms hanging out in the kitchen. So I'm curious if you could talk a bit more about how to get that started and how to use it to its full potential.
The way I have it set up in my house, and a lot of other people do, is you have a bin, like a, just a compost container that you keep in your kitchen where you throw your food scraps. just while they're filling up. And then once that bin is filled up, I take it outside to where my worm bin is and actually throw those in with the worms there. How the worm bins work is they're stackable trays, and you actually start at the with the bottom tray. You throw your food scraps in there, somehow obtain about half a pound to a pound of worms. A lot of nurseries, or there's urban farm supply stores that you can often buy red wiggler worms, and just throw the worms in there, give them a little bit of bedding either with shredded newspaper or coconut husks or anything that's kind of mulchy. They actually like to live and burrow in that cellulose. And they do like it to stay a little moist, so usually just adding food scraps allows for some moisture. And they'll start eating all those food scraps, and then actually there's a bacteria in the digestive tract of the worms that is what breaks the food down and produces the compost that we really want from it. And so as that bottom tray fills up, you can actually just start adding the food scraps to the next tray up, and the worms just travel from the bottom tray up through the holes in the next tray up. So the compost will be ready at the bottom first, and you just start picking out the trays, and you can just go ahead and throw that compost on top of your raised beds and mix it into the topsoil there. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, I have a worm bin underneath the stairs in my place, and I rarely visit it. I might be guilty of worm neglect at some point. But it's worth saying that once it's set up, and a little bit of time at the beginning, great instructions here from May, once it's set up, you don't have to do a lot of work for it. And it's as productive as you want it to be by how much you want to add to it. And it's resilient to the neglect of an urban dweller who forgets they have a worm bin for 3 months at a time. The most important thing is that you do feed them eventually, or they'll starve to death. And then, you know, just like the garden, they don't want to get too cold at night, too hot during the day. You know, they like that sort of comfort zone. And the best thing that you can do if you don't do anything for your worms is give them some fresh newspaper or like carbon mulch, you know, something that they can chew on, like old shredded paper. And junk mail is a great source of that, as long as you don't take out the glossy coupons, because they're pretty useless to the worms. You'll find that taking some like newspaper, maybe the coffee grinds with the filter, just that on its own, once in a while, give the worms a little bit of love. And like May pointed out earlier, they're 24/7. They don't stop making worm compost out of what they do. It's pretty much their jobs.
Thank you.
You're listening to Chew on This. I'm Lisa Rothman. Today we're learning how to make the most of our gardens, even if they're the size of a ping pong table. We'll hear more questions from our audience after this. To Chew on This. I'm Lisa Rothman. We're at San Francisco's Soma Street Food Park. We take a challenge people face in their daily lives and ask experts how to handle it. Today, how to garden even if you don't have much space to work with. Urban gardening experts Jay Rosenberg and May Wynn are answering our questions. If you go to chewonthisradio.com, you'll find all the good ideas they're coming up with.
Hi, I'm Sam. And I live in Noe Valley. In my backyard, we have pretty good sun, but the planting areas are postage stamp, and the sun is shaded by neighbors' trees a lot of the time. What are some plants that I could grow that would be vegetable plants, edible vegetables, I'm thinking chard or kale, that would tolerate this kind of shade mostly?
I'll tell you, you have the best problem yet. Because you talk about having a great spot with plenty of sun, but an abundance of shade. In some ways, you have the best of both worlds, because with a little bit of work, maybe pruning or convincing your neighbors to make some thinning of some branches on one of those trees, you might be able to get some light specifically where you want it. But at the same time, half of this city
is dealing with your fog and shade issue full time, and their gardens are thriving right now with winter greens and lettuces and onions and garlic and amazing, amazing flowers. And I think that if you look to just what's on the other side of the city, where the sun isn't so bright so often, you'll see the kind of shady, kind of loving plants that'll go great right in your hood.
Well, Jay, I was hoping you'd look for me. What is growing in the shade on the other side of the city?
Well, I'd say that the kales and shards right now, red Russian kale is a winter green that is just thriving. And amongst the shards, Swiss shards and the beetroot crops, you'll find French shards and cooking greens like collards, spinach. And at the same time, the lettuce greens, some of the most amazing salad gardens I've ever seen. Gardens just dedicated to having 35 to 50 different varieties of greens for a salad. You'll never have a boring salad again. Or at the far end of the city on the west edge.
That's a great suggestion. Thank you, Jay. I have one more question. I've got a beautiful laurel tree, a feature in the yard, and I'm not about to remove it. But it wants to take over my best planting area, and it's sending out suckers and shoots and roots. Any way to discourage that without killing the tree entirely?
Don't kill the tree.
I won't kill the tree.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know anything.
Yeah, just take out the suckers, prune it down.
I think that you could make the tree smaller through a series of annual prunings, but I wouldn't do that by yourself. If you want to talk about that some more, maybe we'll look at it someday.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Donna Drummond, and I was interested in knowing about vertical gardening and how I should get started and what kind of plants can be grown in a vertical garden.
The magic beans are a really, really good start. They all grow really fast and can get really tall. They'll pretty much grow as tall as you can build your trellis. So just shoot for the stars on that one. There's also other perennial vining plants, things like hops and kiwis and grapes and passion flower grow really, really well in this climate. And they'll also just grow as far as you can trellis them up. And yeah, it's a great technique to grow vining plants along your fences, along any walls that you have, any space that you just want to see as more green. And you can also be getting fruit from those plants. Okay.
I was sort of interested in the Civic Center, there's a community garden, and along the wall they've built a structure, mm-hmm. and they have rows, and they're going to put earth in there and grow things. And I was thinking more along that line, but I don't know what kind of plants they're planning to put in there, so I was wondering about that specifically.
I think I saw that garden, and it had these interesting like pockets.
Yes.
Like they were called the habit tiles, I think. And it was like tiles on the wall that had pockets for dirt, and in each dirt pocket, a plant was growing. And I think the easy win is, even for Lisa, who killed her cactus, it's to grow succulents. Because you don't really have to water the succulents. You can just love them, and they'll just do amazing work. When they die, they make more. Like, it's just beautiful. And you can get a lot of win out of a succulent growing on a bag on a wall. It's so much more pleasant than a wall. But I think if you have enough soil, and you know what I saw in some of those was up to a full 5 gallon bucket's worth of dirt in those shelves or in those louvered wall sides, you can grow a lot in 6 to 8 inches thick of soil, as long as you keep it moist and mulched.
Mulch, that's the key always. Okay, thank you very much.
Hello, my name's Roman Kanacki. My wife and I have a little planter out on our balcony that's about 2 feet by 3 feet that we grow herbs on. And we're having a debate whether using coffee grounds as mulch is good or bad. She says it acidifies the soil. I say it's organic material and it should be good for the soil. Can you help us with that?
I would love to defend the coffee here. a big fan. To be honest with you, it is nitrogen rich and acidic when you add coffee grinds to a garden as a soil amendment. And the best thing to do is really mix it in with something else. And I'm going to go back to the melon problem we had a little while ago. Adding something is a good solution. If you add more organic matter to your garden, you'll be adding more fertility, more life, less fertilizer later perhaps, less frozen melons in the middle of summer. I think what you'll see with the herbs and stuff is you'll want to find a nice mix that provides some carbon as well. And that's, again, just like the problem with the melon, is some good mulch. If you have a wood chip mulch, it might be called nutrient deficient mulch, but you're adding that nutrient with the coffee. That would balance out the like cream and sugar in your cup, and it would balance out the acidity the garden would be taking with a large amount of grinds. And the other thing is you don't have to add it all at once. I wouldn't bury a tree in a mountain of coffee grinds and say, hey, what happened? Why didn't that work? But if you add it a little bit over time, maybe, you know, dressing the garden a little bit, like sprinkles on a Sunday, I bet you'll find that a lot more nutrient will be available to the garden, especially if you mix in that mulch.
I can add something, too. One of my favorite things to do with coffee grounds is actually to feed it to my worms. The worms totally dig the coffee grounds. They kind of get caffeinated themselves, and they just start eating your food scraps like crazy. So, and that's another way of kind of doing that mixing filtration process, so you're not giving your plants all that coffee at once, but it goes through the worm's digestive system before, and then they give you amazing compost. So,
makes this great point. If there's like, oh, I want to do something, and I want to do something to grow food, to be local, more sustainable in my kitchen, if there's one thing to really do, it's about looking at your waste stream, looking at what comes out of your kitchen as a byproduct, as a waste product, and goes into one of the green, blue, or black, or some other bin, and maybe start to consider, what could I keep right here at home in a worm bin and produce something out of it, rather than adding it to the truck, which gets shipped to, you know, who knows where anymore, but it's at least 50 miles and maybe up to 4,000 when you put it in one of those bins. So, you know, this idea of, you know, a worm bin, revolutionary work here. If you can keep some of your scraps, like some of the things that when you chop up to make a soup or something, it doesn't have to go into a landfill. It doesn't even have to go into the city's composting system. I mean, it should if that's the only option. But we can create small-scale composting systems where we have a worm bin or maybe even a small heap for our house or our building with our neighbors or even our block scale. And you can imagine like a block party-style compost flip-out where everyone has a good time and collects all of their green matter from one day. If we did that one day a year, we'd be diverting like 1% of all of the waste that we create over the year. Think about doing that once a week. You know, oh my God, change the world with, you know, 15% of all of our garbage not being sent into trucks, the carbon sequestered, not being using fuel, the not being on a truck, not being dumped, not being off-gassing on some distant heap. We can do amazing things with the local worm bin, and it can fit under your counter, inside the kitchen, with no pests or
smell.
Pain. Yeah, no pain.
You're listening to Chew on This. I'm Lisa Rothman. When we come back, you'll find out how gardens are changing the way people eat in low-income communities and are employing people who've spent time in prison. Listening to Chew on This. I'm Lisa Rothman. Today, we're at the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco. We're finding out how to garden, even if your yard is really small. Our experts are Jay Rosenberg, co-founder of 49 Farms, an organization dedicated to urban farming. We're also joined by Mae Wynn. She's a permaculture designer with Planting Justice, which was founded by Gavin Raiders and Halle Zandi. Let's hear more about what their organization does from some of the people who work with them. They're planting a garden in a neighborhood that houses low-income immigrants. It's in San Rafael, a city that's about 40 minutes away from here, across the Golden Gate Bridge.
Getting it all lined up. Looks like 3 feet to me.
Well, hi, my name is Kevin. I'm from Planting Justice. And we're here at the Canal Project. I'm working on some raised beds right here. Going to put some soil in here so we can do some planting in here and you know, get it looking nice, get it looking real nice.
My name is Julio Madrigal and I'm building this garden for the people in San Rafael. Well, there's basically, this is a community garden. We'll build around 70 beds and it's mostly for the people, and we have split beds, so if people just need half of one bed, they could do that. We also have raised beds for people who really can't bend down to the ground. They could start using these beds, and it's to encourage more people to grow their own plants.
Hello, my name is Salvador Mateo, and I'm an edible landscaper. I work for Planting Justice, which are the ones doing the garden. And, you know, I'm helping the Canal Alliance build a community garden. We've done work all around the Bay Area in San Francisco. We've been here in San Rafael. We've gone to Antioch. East Oakland, West Oakland, North Oakland, Berkeley, Vallejo. About 2.5 years ago, when I was still in high school, I was a senior in high school, and Gavin and Halle, co-founders of Planting Justice, came over to our school for a garden program, and they introduced us to this program that we were going to do. We were going to create a garden in our school, and from there, Gavin and Halle became our mentors. We started working with them, and they started helping us know more about what organic is, how we can implement it into our community. And from there on, after we graduated from high school, they offered us a job with them as landscapers.
All lined up. There we go, there we go. All righty. I've been working for Planting Justice for about 11 months. Yes, and I love it, man. It's real therapeutic.
Met a lady named Beth Waitkiss, which was in the Insight Gardening Program. The Insight Gardening Program is actually out of San Quentin Prison. All the designers, and like I say, Gavin and Halle, the founders, they teach you basically everything you're gonna need to know. So once I got out, I had already been knowing them like 2 or 3 years. So they told me, you know, once I got out, you know, come check us out and, you know, we'll have something for you. So once I got out, I went, you know, met with Gavin and Halle, and they got me started. Things happen in my life, but I've always had a job. I've, you know, worked from Thrifties to UPS, you know, Blockbuster, customer service, Nordstrom's. But I finally found out what I wanted to do, and this is it. This is definitely it.
That was Julio Madrigal, Salvador Mateo, and Kevin Williams hard at work at a Planting Justice project in the Canal District of San Rafael, which is across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. I'm Lisa Rothman, and you're listening to Chew On This. It's time for Think Fast. We have a gourd here that Jay Rosenberg picked from Hayes Valley Farm. It's about 1 foot long. It's green. And it looks like a cross between a watermelon and a dinosaur egg. We've got a picture of it up on our website at chewonthisradio.com, which you could check out if you're playing along at home or on your smartphone, but not if you're driving your car. Here's today's challenge. If the scientific name for carrot is
Daucus carota,
and the scientific name for kale is
Brassica oleracea,
what do you think the scientific name for this big green gourd should be? We're not going for accuracy here. We're going for creativity. Think fast. Time's up for Think Fast. The people here at San Francisco's Soma Street Food Park are turning in their ideas for what they think the scientific name for this gourd should be. At the end of the show, our two gardening experts, Jay Rosenberg and Mei Nguyen, will choose the two winners. You're probably wondering, what will they win? What's today's meal of fortune? Maki rolls from Mana Food Truck. These are very special maki rolls. The vegetarian one has lotus root, bamboo shoots, baby corn, and shiitake mushrooms. The other roll contains a shrimp tempura, and it's topped with spicy, creamy scallops. The Mana Food Truck is the creation of husband and wife team Emily and Francis Ho. I asked them to tell me the story of their truck, starting with how they met.
Well, we met actually in a restaurant too called Ebisu. It's a really well-known sushi restaurant in Sunset District. Yeah, I started working there, and that's how we met.
She on that time is very, very unique person. She dyed the hair, and we call her like Rainbow Lady because she have a red, yellow, green. I never saw a lot of Chinese girls like this way because I'm from Hong Kong. His personality is very good after we find out. Yeah, I think, wow, this is a very, very good combination.
I remember one time that he did something really special to me. Like, he used a lemon and curved it a pig, which was really cute. And that was something that, you know, it was... I still remember that. Even though I don't have the lemon anymore, but I still remember that was a really, really cute thing that he did for me.
Then we not stay too long, around like seven months or 8 months, we decide to marry. And then also at that time I decide to open my own restaurant.
And we get lucky, we got a bigger place in American Canyon. That was a huge place. And the economy didn't go well. So we have to end up closing it after a few years. And after that, we didn't know what we were gonna do. And things, you know, keep falling. We lost our house. It was like really sad. We were searching in like Craigslist, looking for new restaurant space. Just all of a sudden, there's like a food truck pops up, you know, on Craigslist. And we were like looking into it and get to know a little bit more about food truck business. And we realized, you know what? We like this better than, you know, stacking in a restaurant in a box. The name of the truck is called Mana. And so our slogan is like, good eats from heaven.
Of my personal, I would like to cook in the small restaurant, the small kitchen, because it feels like more home style. Small space, the challenge would be like the people walking together. I think small kitchens, one more thing I like it is like, they feel more warm. Yeah, and we can speak very close, we can talk very close. But the big restaurant, sometimes we need the yelling. When you cook something to other person, you can, after they eat, she have a lot of feelings coming out. So that's the way I like to cook it. I like to see people's feeling, yeah. And also it's make people happy.
The main thing that I noticed that the difference between food truck and a restaurant, you have more communication with the other business. People are so much more friendlier. We're running at a food truck than in a restaurant. It's the littlest thing. I mean the littlest thing. Because small is tremendous.
You're listening to Chew On This, on location at the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco. Let's find out more ways that small can be tremendous when it comes to gardening. Urban gardening experts Jay Rosenberg and May Nguyen are answering our questions.
Hi, my name's Erin Hill, and I'm asking a question for my neighbor. She was given a Meyer lemon tree 5 years ago. It's in our backyard in North Beach. It gets partial sun. It is starting to fruit and flower. It's in part clay soil. She dug down 3 feet and then put potting soil around the rest of the roots. But it seems like it's just not doing all that well. It doesn't seem all that healthy. So she's wondering if you know of anything she could do to augment that little tree. One thing I was going to add, it's blocked by a fence a little bit and a dogwood tree, which she said to point out it was a dogwood. I don't know if that makes a difference or not. But
My first suggestion is always add compost for that. What happens when you dig a big hole and put a tree in it and then add just like a totally different type of soil to it without mixing it in with some of the native soil is your tree can become root bound because it'll start to act like it's just in a container of potting soil. So if she does have really clay soil around her, that potting soil might not actually be able to interact that well with the really dense clay soil. So there could be just some soil issues there, and next time she plants a tree, or if that tree is still young enough to be taken out and then have the soil that it's sitting in just mixed with some of the native soil to kind of say, like, hey, you're in this, like, big open space. Like, you should grow as big as you want to get. I'm not sure what the problem is, if it's not producing fruit or it's not, like, producing a lot of branches and leaves. Like, what is indicating that it's not doing so well?
It does have fruit, but I think it just has so much potential. It's, you know, it'll have maybe 5 little fruits, but it's big enough, but it's just not flowering and fruiting as much as we think it probably could. So,
First of all, you know, it'd be great to see how the neighbor's lemon tree is doing. So looking around the block and seeing if the other trees are performing similarly. And the questions about the soil that you planted it into, you'll probably can figure that out over time. But what I found when I were transplant a tree is that in order to, like, invigorate the root system and to give it some growth, is to give it a pruning, is to give it a deliberate haircut and say, all right, let's get growing in this spot now.
Okay.
And it's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. But this is the time of year, this wintry time is perfect for the evergreens, your citrus and your evergreen trees to be pruned, because it's that, you know, best time of year to do that. And if you had to, like, make a decision and you had no guidance, but you're like, I'm pruning it, just look out. There's, like, three things that you should look for. You should look for any branches that are damaged. And if they're damaged, they're great to prune right then and there. And then look for branches that are diseased, like they have a fungus or some weird... cut those off. And then the last of the three best places to prune, and don't do too much at once because you can't regrow the tree right away if you prune too much, is to find the branches that are maybe going in the direction you don't like. And those are the three D's for pruning fruit trees, is make decisions around damaged, diseased, or in the wrong direction. And the best direction for a tree branch is up. So the worst is down. So if you have a beautiful branch and then it has a branch going down, that's a great choice.
Perfect. Thank you so much. That's really
helpful. Hi, my name's Maggie, and I've lived in a small apartment for many years, and I'm also gardening challenged. And I want to know, are there any herbs or vegetables that I could grow in a pot that are going to do okay in an apartment? I don't even have porch access.
Right. So you're thinking about growing, like, red in your kitchen in a sunny spot.
Right. Or somewhere that maybe gets, you know, partial light or indirect light even.
Mm-hmm.
Do you make breakfast?
Yes.
And do you, like, make omelets and stuff like that?
Occasionally.
What do you make when you cook up some breakfast?
That's a hard question.
Let's make believe you have eggs.
Maybe some eggs, yeah.
And maybe some
eggs.
Toast.
Sure, scrambled eggs with some vegetables in it.
You can easily add, like, rosemary or thyme or something that can grow, like, right on a windowsill or a box or even a container on the counter that gets a little bit of light when you're making up your eggs.
Okay.
You can also easily have, like, a parsley or a chive, a little green onion added to your toast, you know, just that little extra flavor.
And they don't need a lot of room.
Maybe 2 inches deep and 3 inches wide. I mean, yeah, the amount of soil we had today in our little exercise, basically a 4-inch pot.
Okay.
You can get started with that and have something that you could prune right from right away and be getting a little yum.
Excellent.
And the more you prune them, the more they'll grow, too. Plants actually want to be picked. So you'll be surprised if you harvest that little thyme plant in that little 4-inch pot and you keep harvesting it but leave enough for it to just keep growing, you'll get a lot of mileage out of it.
I'm consistently amazed by what people show me they're growing on their fire escapes or their windowsills. And the under kitchen counter worm bin combined with the sink water overflow that never gets maintained. And people are really amazing and want to tinker. And I think you find a little bit of space, and you have some tension and time for it, you'll get a lot out of it.
Are there vegetables I could try?
You know, it's tough when you don't have the wind and the pollination and all that stuff that happens outdoors. And I guess this goes back to that question earlier of, like, well, what do you mean by a permaculture garden as opposed to just a box of food? We're trying to build an ecosystem. We're trying to welcome life, creating life by inviting more life. And the worms bring compost and fertility. The birds and bugs bring the pollination and the bonus. And in that, what we're ultimately trying to achieve is less work for us. Less work for us in our gardens. More self-maintained systems. When we walk through the forest, we don't find anybody watering it. We don't find anybody weeding it. We don't find anybody fertilizing it. You might be lucky enough to find somebody harvesting from it. But for the most part, it's a self-maintained system. And the term for, you know, removing a forest is deforestry. Like, that's the only way to stop a forest from growing is to remove it. And that's the design I'd like to implement for our gardens, is a garden that doesn't need us to visit it consistently to maintain or to water or to fertilize, but to really have it be self-resilient, self-reliant, and self-fertilizing, and using gravity for water and local shade plants for windbreak so that the wind doesn't blow it over. And with that, you'll find that you can get a lot of enjoyment from sitting and watching it grow and having a food byproduct that's just delicious and abundant.
Thank you, Jay Rosenberg with 49 Farms and Mae Nguyen with Planting Justice for sharing your gardening expertise with us today. Our time together is drawing to a close, which means we've got some delicious maki rolls from Mana Food Truck to give away. At this very moment, our experts are adjudicating the scientific names people came up with for the gourd. It looks like a cross between a watermelon and a dinosaur egg. The winners are...
Muriel Ullman with Cucumberus blimpus.
And we have Sam G with Green Lumpus Paperweightia Giganteus.
And just so you know, the actual scientific name for the gourd is?
Cucurbita fissifolia.
So Sam and Muriel won the Meal of Fortune with skill, but you can win with luck as well. People put their names in the official Chew on This picnic basket, and the lucky Meal of Fortune winners are...
Joanna Bonheim.
John O'Dev.
Rachel Harmon.
Tony Domensky.
And Sam Geffner.
Our production engineer is Jim Bennett. Matt Martin, the general manager of KALW, is our advising producer. Ashley Ann Krigbaum is our outreach coordinator and production associate. Maggie Ballard is our creative consultant. Our mic mavens today are Erica Bridgman and Erica Moo. The sound editor is Eric Wayne. Brent Norton composed the theme music. Justine Choi, Melissa Fries, Luis Granados, Julieta Kusnir, and Connie Chan Wang are the show's idea advisors. Thanks to our audience here for asking such great questions. And thanks to the owner of the Soma Street Food Park, Carlos Muela, and everyone at KALW's Cross Currents. So I want to check in with you. Have you had a bite yet? What are you particularly enjoying about that maki roll?
It's actually a lotus fruit. It's the vegetarian. It's delicious. It's crunchy.
I like the spicy texture and the perfectly done rice.
How about you?
It's very saucy and great with using your hands for.
Go to chewonthisradio.com for information about upcoming episodes, more gardening suggestions, and a place to share your own gardening successes and challenges. I'm Lisa Rothman. We've heard a lot of great ideas today. Until next time, try one out and let us know how it goes.